Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Terence Bendixson, journalist and author, is probably the longest-serving campaigner for pedestrians throughout the world and is now the president of Living Streets in the UK, the charity formerly known as the Pedestrians Association. He was recruited to the cause in the 1960s by Tom Foley, the association's co-founder, after an article he had written in The Guardian about the dominance of cars in our cities and towns. He's a strong believer in encouraging people to walk their daily errands, being aware of how street pattern and layout can influence travel behaviour and enhance or limit the experience of travel on foot. He's lived almost all his life in Chelsea, now a prized neighbourhood of London. Our conversation takes place there one sunny morning along roads he has walked since he was 11.
We're in Chelsea.
Yes.
And you've actually lived here for a very long time.
Well, I'm old enough for my sister and I to have been sent off to Canada during the war as evacuees. When we came back in 1945, my father had died in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. My mother took a flat a few streets away from here, and I used to walk down to the King's Road, get the 11 bus to go to school. So, yes, 1945, 46, 47, I was living here.
That must have been a hell of a shock when you came back from Canada and discovered you hadn't got a dad any longer. How old were you when you...
I was 11 then. It was a shock. I think the greatest shock was meeting my mother again, who'd been in the army, was a female major, and a woman of tremendous character and strength. And I hadn't been used to being managed by someone like that.
And where were you in Canada when you were a child?
Partly in Montreal. I went to school in Montreal. My sister and I were lodged with Scots Canadian merchant families, leading families in Montreal, incredibly generous to Britain, with a great warmth towards us. They took us in at no cost whatsoever. But my family, the Drummonds, actually lived in the country after my first year. So I lived out on a mountainside, a hillside, south of Montreal. And then all the other families came out in the summer, and we were 20 or so children who had the most blessed freedom you could imagine.
A very different story to children who were left behind here.
Yes, yeah. Lots of food, lots of generosity, and miles of space.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about where we're walking. So
we're in old Chelsea here. The old spine of Chelsea was what's now called Old Church Street. It runs north and south from the Fulham Road down to Chelsea Old Street on the Thames embankment. And it's just a little bit further ahead of us, and on either side of Old Church Street there are nests of quite small houses, little streets which wiggle about, and then one or two squares, and it's one of the most prized locations in London, I think. I live a little bit further north from here in Elm Park Gardens, and it is 400 yards, perhaps 500 yards from where my mother took a flat in 1945. So, and then at one other point, I did live 750 yards or maybe 800 yards from where I live now. So, yes, I'm stuck in the mud.
Fantastic. All right, it's really nice to meet someone who's lived somewhere. It's never lacked. It's always been the right place to stay.
Yes, although I've worked abroad. I worked in Chicago. I've worked in Los Angeles building swimming pools. And I worked in San Francisco. And I've worked in Paris. So, but I'm a cities man. I seem always to have worked in cities.
And so what was the work you were doing? I mean, apart from building swimming pools.
I read history at Oxford, so I'm your classic know-nothing-about-anything kind of person, not professionally qualified at all. I worked as a journalist in Chicago, went hoping to get a job on the best paper, and ended up on the worst paper. So I found my level. I built swimming pools in Los Angeles, and then in San Francisco worked for an import-export firm. So I was just taking any job that was going. But in mind always was journalism.
Your role is now something, is it president or chairman?
I'm president of Living Streets, which means I'm the figurehead. I preside over annual general meetings and some other meetings that we have, but there's the chairman of the committee who's really fully responsible for the association as a trustee. I'm not a trustee. And then there's a director who is in charge of day-to-day operations. And Living Streets is a big business these days, with 20, 25 people working for it, working in schools, working in firms, pushing for walking, more walking, creating cities and towns that are good for walking.
So you've been involved with Living Streets for a very long time. How and why did you get involved?
Well, it was the 1960s. I was working on The Guardian. It was the motor age. We were pouring money into motorways in Britain. Was it because I'd walked around Chelsea and lived in this part of London as a boy? I don't know, but I just knew walking was important. I wrote a piece in The Guardian saying that walking was absolutely essential and we were disregarding it, and transport policies and the minister needed to think about walking. And I got a telephone call from Tom Foley, who was the chap who had founded the Pedestrians Association in 1920, never quite sure, it was 29 or 27, but one of those, just late 20s. He'd founded it with Lord Cecil, who was a brother of Lord Salisbury and a key actor in the setting up of the League of Nations after the First World War. These two men could see that cars were killing people, killing cities, set up the Pedestrian Society. Anyway, Tom rang me up, said, come and have tea in St. Ermin's Hotel, and I was hooked.
And that was it.
That was it. And I joined the committee. I, in due course, became chairman. And then here I am. I'm by far the longest-serving member of the association, and I'm president.
Let's go back a bit to the sort of 60s and 70s. What was Chelsea like, and what was London like?
Good question. Parking meters had just come in as early as 1959 in Westminster, so there was awareness that parking was overwhelming the city, but the control was only in the centre of London, so in Kensington and Chelsea, you could park anywhere, and people did. Whether congestion was worse then than it is now, terribly hard to judge. But cars, of course, smelt much more than they do. The streets were full of the smell of petrol. I mean, the extraordinary thing about this neighbourhood, Chelsea, is although what's going on inside these houses is different from those days. In the 1960s, Chelsea was full of old-fashioned people and lodging houses and common boarding houses. Now, it's bankers and international people of one sort or another. But the place looks much the same.
But the streets themselves are quite narrow, aren't they? And parallel parking all keeps us on a rather narrow pavement.
Keeps us on a narrow pavement, but it certainly slows the cars down, and it's still a very comfortable place to live in. But you can hear the cars going past now. There are too many of them. They're too noisy. And increasingly, people are aware that they're fouling in the air that we breathe.
Is it speed of vehicles, which was the thing that the Pedestrians Association was, you know, an issue for a long time? Was that the one that sort of brought everyone together?
The 1930s were the key period for regulating traffic. And we understand that Tom Foley, the co-founder of the association, that he was the man who actually came up with the idea of the pedestrian crossing with the zebra stripes. So the prime preoccupation was pedestrian crossings and, of course, speed limit. As you correctly say, people drove fast when they could in those early days. There was no town speed limit, and the Pedestrians Association played a key role working with Lord Cecil in the House of Lords to modify the Road Traffic Acts to get, as I say, pedestrian crossings, a 30-mile-an-hour town speed limit, and, amazingly, driving tests.
It's in the news this week, isn't it, that they're actually changing the driving test to include the requirement to understand and the use of a sat-nav. And they're saying, you know, it's so many years or decades since they've made any change in the driving test. So the driving test was something that the Pedestrians Association, it was through their campaigning that it came to fruition.
I've got one little bit more personal history to tell you. My mother, who was born in 1904, was buying her first motor car in the late 1920s, and she used to tell the story of how she bought it in Reading because she was working for the Reading General Hospital. She went into the showroom, she decided she would have this one or that one, and the salesman said, "Well, Miss Palgrave, let's take it out on the road and I'll show you how it works." And they drove round the block, and at that point he handed the keys to her and said, "Here is your car." That was all you did.
I certainly know that my mother, she was a driver in the war, so she drove all sorts of vehicles, and she had never had a test.
Right.
No, and she absolutely was insistent that we as children, that we should pass our driving test, because having a car and being able to drive gave you such independence, and she claimed dignity.
Yes.
And that was something I was going to come on to, was that as we grow older, are holding on dearly to their cars. And often it is a sort of loss of being able to travel independently, they say, you know, is the sort of great loss of dignity. And GPs are reluctant to take away people's driving licence.
Interesting points. I think to go back to my mother, like yours, she drove in the war. She drove for ACAT command all over the place. She lived to her 90s. She said giving up her car was one of the most difficult decisions she ever made. So that corroborates what you're saying. Having said that, I think all the evidence shows that elderly drivers drive on roads they know, they don't go on motorways, they tend not to drive at night. They do end up having crashes, but I don't think that one regards them as a primary threat to the rest of us. They're probably a threat to themselves rather than anything else.
Now, you use that word. You use the word crash and not the word accident.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you got any comment on the use of the vocabulary of highways and travel?
I think until probably the 1970s, something like that, accident was the word that was used by everyone for any incident on the road. And then some of us must have woken up to the fact that accident, that suggests, well, it came from God. It was sort of something completely unforeseeable. And we realized what a lot of nonsense that was and started calling incidents crashes and making the point that they were preventable. They could be foreseen. There were patterns, and that they were anything but accidents.
Now, you, in your time, have written a couple of books, and you're writing one at the moment, you told me. I know there's one back there because I've teased you about it a little bit. That it is about, I think it's called A Future Without Cars.
I wrote a book called Instead of Cars, which was published here in hardback and then by Penguin and in the United States and in Japan, thanks to the energies of my publisher, Maurice Temple Smith. It wasn't all that polemical. It just said, look, these things are possible. We don't have to turn all of our cities into Los Angeles. There's another way. The more roads you build, the more parking you provide, the more opportunities you provide for people to own cars and drive cars. And if you don't provide all of that, and you build metros, provide bus services, allow Uber to run alongside black cabs, then other possibilities open up for people. And it's not so much a case of coerce, it's town planning, it's traffic management, it's municipal action.
Transport for London, Living Streets and Bloomberg all came together.
Yes.
You had lots of people come together.
Yes.
What seemed to come from it, I felt, was, gosh, there's still so much that we could be doing, and yet we haven't done it.
Yes. Yes.
Am I picking up the wrong vibe there, or am I picking up the right vibe?
No, I think that's a very fair point. We are doing a lot, and we have been doing a lot, well, in Britain, in a way, ever since London Street in Norwich had to be dug up for gas mains or water mains or some service to be replaced. And so, as the most important shopping street in the town, suddenly no cars could drive down it. And Alfred Wood, who was the architect and planning officer, persuaded the council, after the works were all over, not to let the cars back in. Well, that was in the 1960s, so, you know, things were beginning to happen, but you're absolutely right. We're still clobbered with cars, and look at these little streets there, full of parked cars.
And what I always find, you know, maybe it may change with autonomous vehicles or sharing cars, but they're just empty space.
Yes.
And they're there for... they only make one or two journeys a day sometimes,
yes.
If that.
Yes. Or less. You're quite right. I mean, I think the figures... it's reckoned that most cars, or cars on average, are used for only 5% of the time or less. So you're quite right. They're just sort of sitting there, occupying space, being a blockage, making it more difficult for us to cross the road here, for instance. And we aren't yet touching that problem, although here we are in Chelsea, there's residence parking. You as a stranger bringing your car would find it very difficult to park had you come by car. So there is that level of control, but the control favours the residents. It enables the residents more conveniently to have cars. So we haven't made that much progress there, and it remains to be made.
In terms of where we've walked, we've had sort of very narrow points where we've had to... you've had to let me go forward, or I've had to let you go forward. There are sort of lamp standards in our way and cable boxes, a couple of bollards. But nonetheless, the actual physical environment is not that much better than it has been for countless years.
There were very few cars parked in all of these streets when I was a schoolboy, and they don't improve the look of the place unless you love Porsches so much that you look at that one over there and you think, what a beautiful object it is. It improves the look of the street. But the street would be better looking if it didn't have that row of parked cars in it. And we haven't really scratched the surface of that problem yet.
So why is it?
People talk about owning cars being a sign of status, and I'm sure that is true. And if you own a Rolls Royce and I own a Ford, it puts you above me, and everybody knows that. But it's the sheer convenience of being able to walk out of your place of wherever you're working or living and get into your own private cabin and trundle off with your music or your lipstick if you're a woman, or all those little personal possessions which are great conveniences. It's hard to know how to replace that. I'm interested in autonomous cars. Will they come? Will driverless cars come? But if they do come, what will be the consequences of that? But one of the most interesting questions to ask about autonomous cars is, will people be happy to give up having all those things in the dashboard pocket, which are so convenient, whether you're a man or a woman? Because little things like that tend to determine quite big questions. And I think another thing that crosses my mind, I mean, let's stick here to Chelsea in the middle of London. Let's say the local authorities, Transport for London and the boroughs in these inner parts of London, said, we're going to move towards a time when there are no private cars, it's all autonomous. And then one would get out one's mobile phone, one would, just as in ordering an Uber, one would enter a code or whatever, and in a very short time, a driverless car would arrive outside the shop or the house or the office where you were. You'd jump into it, and you probably already would have told it where you were going to go. That would be incredibly convenient. Might that not mean that all sorts of people started using cars to get around central London, who at the moment walk?
Exactly. Although I'm not sure they'll get into a car that, you know, the dog has left all the hairs on the seat, or I don't know, we'll see. Okay, this is the sort of time when I ask you to recommend a couple of walks.
Yes, I do think that one of the most wonderful creations in London since my boyhood is that Thameside walk, particularly along the South Bank. It was always there in front of Thomas's Hospital, across from the Palace of Westminster, but now it runs on down past the Festival Hall and the National Theatre and on and on and on, right down to Tower Bridge. And I think that's one of the greatest amenities that has been created in London in my lifetime. And I love it.
And do you recommend any particular time of day or any time of day to avoid because it's so full of people? Or
at different times of the day, it has different attractions, but it's good at night as well.
Okay, so that's one recommendation.
Yes.
Have we got another one?
I think my other recommendation, and how could it be otherwise, given my long association with Living Streets and the Pedestrians Association, is always walk if you possibly can. Walk in the rain, walk with an umbrella. Don't somehow think that walking is only a fine day, sunny day experience. Walking is part of the city experience. It happens to be good for you. It raises your morale. It makes your mind work a little bit more energetically. It has such advantages. And it's a sociable business as well. So keep walking.
Question I haven't asked you about, which I think is quite pertinent, I haven't really asked you anything about finding your way about. So can I ask sort of straight away and say, are you good at finding your way about?
My wife and I pull one another's legs about it, because I tend to say I'm never lost, and of course that's a lie. I am from time to time lost, but 90 times out of 100 I'm not lost. That's true whether we're in a car in Sardinia or walking around London or York or somewhere like that. I think it's to do with observation. I think if you're noticing things, you have a sense of where you are.
It's pretty good timing, actually, for people who are involved in campaigning, because the government has just issued a walking and cycling strategy.
Yes.
Is that not right? Or
yes.
Is it a consultation document?
No, it's a strategy, and it's backed with money. It's an investment plan for cycling and walking, and we've seen in London with the cycle tracks that Boris Johnson introduced that quite big money can be involved. So the new plan is for government walking and cycling strategy backed with money, which will go to local authorities up and down the country. And there is a target in particular to try and get 55% of all primary school children walking to school by 2025. Can't tell you what the percentage is now, but it's substantially below that. So I think we will see a huge amount of the walking strategy money going into school networks of walkways around schools, better pedestrian crossings and so on and so forth.
You've already talked a bit about the value of walking.
Yes.
But a little bit of walking wisdom. What would be your little bit of walking wisdom for someone who perhaps has rather taken walking for granted?
I have an idea that it does all start and end with schools. And if you've got children and you can walk them to school rather than driving them to school, if you can persuade the local authority to make it better for you, particularly yourself, to walk your children to school, and for them then to walk themselves to and fro, both gets the children acclimatized to the idea of walking and of looking about. I certainly walked my children to school. I can remember talking to them about all sorts of things. But it gets the children acclimatized to the idea, and it gets the parents into a position where they need to get in touch with the local authority and say, make it better. And if we can get more people pressing their councillors to create better conditions for walking, that could cause a revolution.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Terence Bendixson. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.